dark and full of terrors.
The night is dark and full of terrors.
You have until our provisions arrive, provisions which will help us break into your elegant home. If you don't deliver him by the aforementioned time, we'll release the beast on him and on you. We don't want to kill our own. Please just let us purge.
Why are you doing this to us?
Because you are home.
The second you get within 2 feet of me, I'm going to snap your neck and crack your spine. And I'll shoot you dead, and his spine will be cracked. And you'll be dead, and his spine will be cracked.
He's bluffing.
How do you know that?
Huh? He's FBI. He knows this stuff.
Yeah, Paul. I know that stuff.
Please just let us go. Look, you have everything ahead of you. You're still so young. Nothing's really happened yet. We could just say George's leg broke on the boat. Everyone will believe us, I promise you.
Please don't do this. Why are you degrading yourself? This is as painful for me as it is for you.
You don't know anybody by the name of Iris?
I don't know nobody named Iris.
No? Got a gun?
Get out of here.
Suck on this.
I am death. Vengeance is mine.
Winter is coming.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the USA, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you?
I am well.
And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
Wonderful. How are you?
Good. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, this is Abe.
Abe, how's it going?
I'm all right. Glad to be here.
Excellent. And we have a special guest tonight. Some folks may know her from various other appearances on the podcast and from the state of Connecticut.
My name is Christy Peterson Schoonover, and I'm a short story writer, mostly of dark fiction and magical realism. And I'm not from the state of Connecticut, Phil. I am a proud Connecticut American. I'm just going to.
Clearly, she's listened to the show before.
That's awesome. Awesome. So, Christy, are you actually from Connecticut originally, or did you grow up somewhere else?
Yes, sadly, no. I am from Connecticut originally. I managed to move about 7 miles down the road from where I grew up. So, and I'm still trying to get out.
So you used to live, what, in Newtown and then or something like that? Or?
I lived in New Milford, which is about, like I said, my dad's house was 7 miles directly north of me. Like, if you got on the road and drove 7 miles, that was my dad's house. But it was a nice growing up experience. I mean, we had a house on the lake, so we had a private beach, which was nice.
Nice.
Yeah, it was very nice, and I'm missing it now. When we sold the house, I lost the beach, and I was like, damn. You know?
That stinks.
Now, the house was horrible, but the beach was awesome. Like, so.
Oh, well, no matter. As long as you have the beach, who cares about the house?
Yeah, exactly. I was all about the beach all summer. Yeah. But, yeah, so.
Now, you actually wrote a novel as well. I don't know if folks know about that.
Oh, yes, I did. I wrote a novel called Bad Apple. And I have a collection of short stories out there called Skeletons in the Swimming Hole, Tales from Haunted Disney World. And for those of you who are Poe fans, I wrote a novella, which is published, that you can look up through Vagabondage Press. Actually, Dark Alley Press now, because they did some shifting and they kind of repurchased the rights to the book and republished it. It's called This Poisoned Ground. So if you like The Fall of the House of Usher, if you like Legia, if you like Aura by Carlos Fuentes, then you will like This Poisoned Ground. So that came out, oh my gosh, I think it was like a year and a half ago now. That was published in January of 2014. So.
Nice. And you have a short story collection about Disney World and ghosts?
Yep. Skeletons in the Swimming Hole, Tales from Haunted Disney World. That is ghost stories set in Disney parks. And actually related to that, and I'll be brief, a friend of mine, Megan Guidry, who I went to Goddard with to get our master's in creative writing, she had a very strong connection with Disney World as a child also. And so her father passed away and my father passed away and they were very close to each other. And she contacted me the other day and she is writing, and the first part is published, a 5-part series on our trip to Disney World and how it relates to alternate ways of mourning, like mourning the death of a parent. It is published in, what is the name of it? It's Applied Sentience. And you can find that online, Applied Sentience. And the first part just went live this week. So that was really magical to just hear. I know one of our listeners, Travis Heckel, had gone and read the first part because he's a big Disney fan and he's in the Facebook group. So he went and checked it out and he was like, oh, this is really interesting. So she did a lovely job and it was kind of interesting and intimate because I had to provide photos of not only us on our trip together, the two of us, but pictures of me when I was like a little kid in like 1972 with my dad. You know, it was very interesting. And to read about Disney parks in such an intimate way and such an unusual way is also interesting. And what was even more interesting to me was that it kind of connected with my idea of the whole ghost stories. So that was fun. But yeah, so.
Nice, nice. And speaking of that, darkdiscussions.com, our website, and we have a Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast, which is what Christy was referring to. And we have darkdiscussions.aol.com for emails and attached files that you can record as voicemails. And if folks who listened recently, we had a couple of those that we played on the It Follows episode. And I know a few folks here. Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Ascansity Podcast. That's Ascansity. You can find it on the iTunes Store and Stitcher.
And Mike, you do a genre book?
Yes, it's called Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
Very good. And Abe, you do a genre book?
Yep, it's called A Really Movie Reviewer. You can find a link to it on the Dark Discussions main page, and just by searching it on Google, whatever search engine you use. I also have articles scattered around the Facebook page as well.
Very good. And also myself, Mike, and Eric do a sister podcast to this one called You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, which is our weekly podcast on the most recent episode of everyone's favorite show, Game of Thrones, except yours, Christy, because I know you're not a big fantasy person.
Yeah, I think I had mentioned this before. Basically, when I went to URI, University of Rhode Island, 20 years ago, I minored in medieval history. And I had a wonderful professor who was a genius. But basically, it was 3 years of my life doing nothing but medieval. And once I was done with that, I can't even watch stuff with medieval now. I'm just so over it. I don't, you know, it's like, it might be wonderful, but I just get bored. Yeah, I'm just tired of it. I just got tired of it. It's hard to explain. It's not my favorite thing. But one of these days, I'm sure I'll pick it up. I mean, what's really funny is I own all the seasons. In anticipation that someday I will, yeah, I own all the Game of Thrones seasons that are out on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever. I own them all in anticipation
that
someday. Yeah, I know I'm odd. Someday I'm going to watch it, but not now. Maybe before I die, it's on my bucket list. But yeah, because it's wonderful and I'm sure it's an awesome show. I just can't handle medieval. It was just so intense for those 3 years that I just finally was like, I can't even deal with it. Like even Robin Hood, which I used to love, gives me the creeps. So,
All right, yeah.
That's fair.
All right. It's odd. Yep. But
all right. So, Christy, actually, you were going to join us in one of our previous episodes. However, you were saying that you were volunteering at the aquarium recently and had a gala that you had to go to, so you couldn't record with us. But we did the film Spring, and we know you watched it. What was your opinion of it? Your 10-minute, 5-minute opinion of it.
Okay, I can do less than that. I loved it. I thought it was genius. I loved the connection, especially to Pompeii. I've always been a fan of Pompeii. In fact, Haraldur Sigurdsson, who was one of the premier scientists who worked on a lot of Pompeii and Herculaneum, was funded by the University of Rhode Island and was teaching classes there. And that's how I ended up going to URI, even though I was going for journalism. I ended up going there because my original intended major was archaeology, with marine biology. That's what I wanted to do. And he was there, and he was an Icelandic volcanologist, and he was teaching, and he had done a lot of work in Pompeii. So I was very fascinated with Pompeii. So this movie, the movie Spring, really spoke to me on so many levels. The idea with the volcano erupting at the end, and then that's her rebirth as a new person. I loved the tension of that last moment at the end. I just thought it was an excellent film. But it is a thinking person's film. It's not, if you want thrills and chills and gore, you're not going to get it in there. But I thought it was beautiful. So I'm going to order the DVD if it's not already available. I put it on my wish list.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and I think that's what we pretty much all said, right, Eric and Mike, Nabe, that it wasn't a thrills and chills, and it was more like the art house thinker type
person. Absolutely, yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, very good. Yeah, it would have been great to have you on the episode, but... these things happen. However, we do have you on tonight, and we have a film I think you probably liked as well, but we'll find out. Now, anybody want to discuss anything prior to that? Have anybody seen or watched or read anything that's genre-related that would be interesting for our listeners? Eric, why don't you start?
I watched something, but I'm not sure I want to mention it because it's a tie-in to an episode we're going to be doing in the future. So I guess the short answer is not that I'm going to talk about tonight.
All right, that's fair. What about you, Mike?
You know, I don't think I've actually watched anything. I actually haven't even managed to get to see the Avengers yet. I'm probably going to have to do that this weekend. But I don't know if I mentioned watching Daredevil the last podcast we did, which was on Netflix. No, actually, I think I did mention it, didn't I?
No, you didn't. And was this the TV show?
Yeah, the TV series on Netflix, which I think they did a pretty good job with. I don't know that I was as enamored with it as some other people, but some people are really, really enamored with it. So I think it was a very good project. I think of the various TV series on right now that are based on comic book properties, it's probably the best one.
Is this a Netflix original?
Netflix original, yes.
Okay. Interesting. All right. So it is a little better than the Josh Whedon one, then.
He never made one.
Yeah, didn't he produce or what? Like, I swore he had a superhero.
Oh, the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. you're talking about?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's just sort of he signed off on it. He's filmed the pilot, but for the most part, it's his. I think it's like his brother and his wife or something that run the show rather than him.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. All right. Now, and Mike, I know you were watching season 3 of Bates Motel. How's that going still?
It's going pretty well. I'm falling a little bit behind again. I know I mentioned in a previous podcast I was watching it, and again, it's not as well crafted as, let's say, Hannibal, which I think they both started at the same time. In both highly dubious adaptations of film, of TV adaptations of pre-existing films, but both of them work. And, again, I strongly recommend the series, and it's just sort of a fun watch. And mostly because of the actors. It's a bit pulpy. It's a bit, could be a little over the top at times, but it makes it fun.
And, the lead actress, what's her name?
Vera Farmiga from The Conjuring.
Yeah, so she's still okay. Yeah, very good. And how many episodes per season is that?
I'm thinking about a dozen. So it's a short run. So like 10 to 12, sort of like The Strain was or Breaking Bad was.
Now, any other items? Yeah, go on. Continue.
Oh yeah, speaking of items, yeah. I recently got a package in the mail from Horror Block. I don't know if you've heard of them.
No.
Okay. Well, have you heard of Loot Crate?
No.
Has anybody heard of Loot Crate?
Nope.
No.
Okay. Loot Crate is this thing where it's a subscription service. You basically pay a monthly fee, and they send you crap, usually promotional crap. Now, Loot Crate does, like, would do, like, a rotating theme every month. Like, one month you would get fantasy crap, and another month you might get superhero crap, and then another month maybe you'd get sci-fi crap or whatever it was. And I gave them a try, you know, because they were like looking around, I guess, mining Facebook data, and thought I would be a good person to do it for. The problem was that, well, first of all, a lot of the crap is stuff that could be promotional stuff or just miscellaneous things. It doesn't, it's not all necessarily high quality. It's, you know, some tchotchke stuff, and but it's fine. It's a fun little thing, but it all depends on how much you're into the theme for that month. And a rival company opened called Nerdblock, and they have several specific competing themes. Like, there's a video game theme, there's a superhero theme, and there's a horror theme. So you could subscribe strictly to the horror theme, and you'll get horror-themed items every month. And every month comes with a t-shirt, among other items. And so I tried doing a subscription, and I just for 3 months, and I'll see if I like it or not. And I got my first package a couple of days ago. And it came with an Evil Dead themed t-shirt, in my size. They do run up to larger sizes, I think 4 or 5X. I don't know how small they go because that's really not my concern. They came with the latest issue of Roomwork magazine. I don't know if it comes with that every month or if this was just for this month's feature. It had like a little vinyl figure of the Ecto-1 from Ghostbusters. A couple of skull-faced shot glasses, since you've mentioned it, Phil, a coffee mug for that's a promo from Bates Motel. Let's see. Oh, and a set of coasters from the Overlook Hotel.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Which has the Overlook Hotel, was it wallpaper or carpeting pattern? I think pattern. Yeah, so a little hexagonal thing. So some neat little stuff. It's something worth taking a shot on if you're interested or looking at it. It's called Horror Block. I think they're run now by Bloody Disgusting as that aspect of the Nerd Block thing. And it's something like $20 a month, and then it's less the more months you buy, right, the longer your subscription is. Which, given that you seem to get a magazine and a t-shirt every month, isn't that bad of a deal.
No, pretty good deal. Most certainly.
The catch is whether you want more crap or not.
So, how long have you been doing this, Mike?
This is the first month I tried this. And so, if I've got two more packages coming. Again, it's a monthly thing. And I'll decide at the end of the next 2 months whether or not it's worth continuing or worth doing. Unless for some reason they want to, choose to sponsor Dark Discussions. But that's me whole. Different thing. But I'll update when I get another package what I got. So, like, the t-shirt was it's an Evil Dead t-shirt. It's I Heart Evil, right? But
Is it the old Evil Dead or the remake?
It's the old Evil Dead. So it says I Heart Evil, like, you know, the I Heart New York. But instead of a heart, it's the face from the Evil Dead poster, right? The skull face with the eyes in it the original. Not Evil Dead, but Evil Dead 2
Evil
poster.
Evil Dead 2, yeah, right.
Right, but it's red, so it fits that whole I Heart theme. You would never know it's a high heart thing if you didn't know the I Heart advertising campaign. But when you know that, it's very obviously taking after that.
Very good, very good.
So if anyone's interested, you can easily go online. They have examples of past packages they've given out and the sort of things that they typically give away. And again, it seems like issues of Rumor Magazine are common, and there's a t-shirt every month.
So, Mike, what was the website of this place again?
You'd go to nerdblock.com, and then you would pick on the exact nerd block you're interested in. And this is from Horror Block. Chrissy, I think I saw a couple of days ago on Facebook you had liked Loot Crate.
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so what I was just talking about is something similar to that called Horror Block.
Okay.
It's a specific horror theme where Loot Crate might have a horror theme in like October or something. It rotates its theme month by month, and the Horror Block is specifically dedicated to horror junk.
Is it Horror Block or Nerd Block? You called it both.
It's Horror Block. Nerd Block is one of them. Searching for either one should come up.
Yeah, it should, because I just discovered it, which is why I clicked like. I just found it. and I haven't even had a chance to like really explore it yet. But yeah, it's definitely on my radar. It looks really awesome.
Nice. And again, it's very hit or miss because I've gotten a few of the loot crates, and some of them were not so good. Some of them were really good, and it depends on what you get each month. Like you don't always get a T-shirt. Sometimes you do. With Horror Block, you get one every month. But it's also, as a result, a little bit more expensive.
Nice. Anything else, Mike, you wanted to mention?
No, I think that pretty much does it. Just that if listeners are wondering, we are going to be covering our last contest winner film, and therefore Skype is acting up on us.
Yes, we had a mind.
The curse of the contest winner is alive and well.
Yeah, every time we do this, it happens. So, all right, it's very good. What about you, Abe? Any items, books, animes, video games, or movies of genre interest that you want to mention for the listeners?
Only one, because I've had finals week, and I have only one more exam tomorrow, so I've had my hands tied. But I did have some time in between.
Ooh, so you had time for games?
Not really. But you know, enough time for one movie, and it was actually the Avengers film.
Okay,
no spoilers.
No, I won't give any spoilers. I actually managed to just do so. It's kind of hard to describe how it would measure up with the first one. It does deliver some great one-liners. It's got some good action. But my experience between the two films is very different because when I went to see the Avengers film, it was during one of its early weeks when after it came out. So the entire thing was jam-packed and full house. So, you know, you got a full-on experience of this big action summer film. But here we are on Tuesday, where it was very quiet. I didn't get that experience. It was hard for me to judge the reactions of the audience with what I managed to see when I saw the first one. Everyone's still very good. They do have a few new additions. Of course, our big bad. Everyone does well with what the work we're working with. The effects, the visuals are really nice. But it'd be cool if you know, if you guys managed to get a chance to see it. It's just curious what you thought, because it's kind of hard to judge it, because currently the consensus between the two films is like it's not as well received as the first one. I mean, it's kind of a tough act to follow, really, if you think about it.
Well, but I did actually see it.
Oh, you did? What'd you think?
Yeah, I just forgot that I saw it. Because it really wasn't that much of a, it was whatever. It was a fun.
Yeah.
I liked the character that was voiced by James Spader, but that's really the only thing I got out of this movie that I didn't get out of the first movie.
Yeah, so not much of a difference then.
No, more of the same.
More of the same, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really have too much that stand out from the first one.
You know, and that's not to say it's a bad movie, because I like the first one and it's more of the same, but it's more of the same. That's all.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I'm sure if the fans of the first one are really going to enjoy it. Hopefully, you know, whatever the plan for the next one will help it stand out a little more, because, as you said, the only thing that they got going for it was the antagonist of it. So yep. It's a half and half, kind of a mixed bag, really. Fun movie, but. I don't know. I'm still mulling over it.
You know, I know it's the most popular film right now, but I heard pretty much the same. I mean, Eric usually gets it right, and it seems that you're basically reflecting the same thing that Eric said. So,
yeah. But what I've heard is that it's a bit choppy, and I guess not every story element is fleshed out. They are going to be, I guess, when it comes out on.
Oh no. The pacing is especially quick in this one.
Well, from what I understand, choppy doesn't necessarily mean that it's not quick. It just means that I'm just relating what's been described, but it's, I do know they're planning on having some footage reinserted for the eventual, DVD release, which Marvel doesn't usually do.
Yeah. So I'm very curious to see what they'll put back in then.
Right. And it's, there's always going to be questions, and there's been fights behind the scenes in a number of the films as to, you know, how much does the filmmaker make their own film, and how much is Marvel forcing them to put things in because we know we really need you to put this character in there so that we can set up this film that's coming out, or we need this scene or we need that scene. And they're like, but it doesn't really fit in the film. That was a lot of the problem people had with Iron Man 2, is that there's this whole middle chunk of the film that was really just setting up the Avengers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Very good. Yeah, for me, I went old school and I watched three films in the past week. I saw the 1973 Jack Hill Pam Grier film Coffee. I've had that one for a while and I decided to watch that. That was a really good film. I would recommend it highly. Then I saw the Roger Corman Jack Hill and Pam Grier film again, The Big Birdcage, and that was really good too. It was Sid Haig is actually in both.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I haven't seen that in a very long time. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I thought so. Oddly, yeah. I watched this one first because the Big Dollhouse was the first one, and even though it's quote unquote a sequel, it's a sequel that isn't related at all to the first. So that was interesting. So I'll probably watch the Big Dollhouse sometime in the next week or two. But I did see another film, Christy, that you've seen, and we discussed actually for a little bit on Facebook. I Married a Monster from Outer Space.
Oh my God. I loved that movie when I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
It was and awesome. I still love it to this day. It's just so excellent.
I actually remember that movie. It was a long time ago, but I do remember that movie.
Go ahead, Phil. Go.
I was just going to say it was really good. It was supposed to be the A film. Back in the, you know, when those films were released, they used to release two together, and there was an A and a B picture, and they were going to make that the A picture, but they decided to make it the B picture because the film that it was with was one of Mike's favorite films, The Blob, and they thought Blob, because it was in color, and it was more action-y, it would be better to put that as the A, and yet, I Married a Monster from Outer Space has received as highly grades from critics as well. They said that the reason it isn't as well known as, say, The Blob or various other films of that era is simply because of the title, because it's more of a sounding like an exploitation title rather than, you know, a true science fiction title.
Well, maybe they needed a theme song by Burt Bacharach.
Yeah. But actually, what's interesting about I Married a Monster from Outer Space is that it's really creepy. I mean, there are some moments in there that are kind of unsettling from what I remember. I haven't watched it recently, but I do own it, so I need to sit down and rewatch it. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Mike, you would like it a lot because it's a body snatcher type film. And I know you like those type of films, and this is, in my opinion, one of the strong ones. It was, as Christy said, it's really, really good. It had its creepy moments, and again, it was paired with one of your favorite films, The Blob, when it first was released at theaters.
Well, The Blob is a nostalgic favorite, but it's not a film that holds up at all after the age of seven. I much prefer the remake.
Right? Yeah, I knew that. I knew that.
We actually didn't. They just re-release the remake on like a Blu-ray or something. Because I think my housemate Charles was talking about it. He just bought it. Yeah, we're all excited. Or he bought it on the first day, and it's been sitting there. And every week or so, he goes, "Hey, are you free to watch it again?"
It's got a great commentary track.
Yeah, that's what he said. He's already cheated and listened to the commentary without me, so I'm gonna have to catch up. But yeah, so.
Well, get revenge by putting it up on eBay and selling it, because it's probably going for a good penny right now.
Yeah, there's a few.
Well, because this is one of those. Yeah, this is a Twilight Time release, and they only do limited releases, and they sell out like in a day.
Yeah, he just turned me on to Twilight Time, and I've been buying a lot of. I mean, I don't even really have disposable income, so I've been buying stuff anyway. Let's put it that way. And movie soundtracks, too. They do a lot of... Is that the one that does a lot of great scores, or is that Screen Archives. I've been buying a lot of rare film scores lately on Screen Archives.
Like, right, but they really tend to sell they tend to be the primary distributor with the Twilight Time, so something's going on with the two of them.
Yeah, they somehow are connected.
Well, that's how I got the Jaws 4 soundtrack. I bought the Jaws 4 soundtrack. I'm a loser. You can all make fun of me now. But it was like they were only releasing like, I don't know, 1,000 copies or something like that. And I was like, first day, I was like, I gotta have it. And that's how I got turned on to it. So now I'm seeing all these other things come out. So
I, the person who would buy the Jaws 4 soundtrack, I don't think can be insulted.
Well, I think they are
above and beyond insults. I think,
I think
the fact that you stand up and you say that, it's like, it's all out there naked for the world. There's nothing more to say.
Actually, though, I would say that a soundtrack doesn't have to be hand in hand with the movie itself, because, you know, the artist that does the music has nothing to do with the film. I mean, so if the film sucks, the music still could be good.
I mean, I do own the Jaws 3D soundtrack, which is gorgeous. There's actually a lot of nice passages in there. But, you know, I had to get that, oh my God, I had to get that limited release back in the early days of eBay, like the really early days of eBay. And I remember paying some ridiculous price for it, like $85 like just to get the CD from England. That was like crazy.
It's too funny.
Now you can get the MP3 for $4.99 or something.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, you still can't get it. I've checked. You still can't get it. At least up until 6 months ago, you still, cause I want to get a separate MP3 copy, even though I have CD copies, but I don't want to like rip because that's too much work for me to rip. I just want to pay $5 and no. So I actually check. I'm like, when is this going to be available that I can just rip it for $5 extra? It's still not out there.
Don't you just have to stick it in the computer?
Well, yeah, but then it downloads, and then I got to go to my other computer to burn it to a CD, and it's kind of a pain in the ass. So
got
to
click on a thing, and
it's a pain in the butt.
hey, the way we had problems with Skype earlier today, I can understand you want to stay away from computers. That's for sure. What about you, Christy? Have you seen any films or movies or other things like soundtracks or whatever that you wanted to mention recently?
Absolutely. I've actually had a really busy couple of months. I saw a bunch of horror movies in the past couple of weeks. I saw It Follows and Unfriended in the theaters. It Follows I absolutely adored. I thought it was amazing. And what was interesting about that experience is that there were only 3 people in the theater. It was me, my friend, and this other woman. And this other woman had to leave, spoiler alert, and use the ladies' room. And she was sitting a few rows in front of us. We didn't even know her. And she left right before, I guess, Greg, or who's the character that gets screwed by his mom?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She left right before that scene. So she came back and she literally looked at us and said, I don't mean to be rude, but what did I miss? And we were like, you missed this, this, and this. And it was just a really interesting experience because after that, we sort of bonded. And that was fun. Unfriended was okay. I mean, I enjoyed watching them using different technologies as a way to tell a story, but I'm not really going to remember it. You know, I'm not going to run out and buy it. It was all right.
Right. That's what I said. I'm not going to remember it a year from now.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, but I'm glad I saw it. I did enjoy having to sit there and read stuff, but you know, I like films with subtitles, so that's just me. I got a VHS to DVD converter, so I've been watching all my old horror movies that I had.
Nice.
Okay, either bootlegged off of old VHS stores, I'll admit it, because I had, you know, I'm kind of an AV geek, so I had a lot of stuff that a lot of people didn't have, like 20 years ago. So I was ripping off stuff out of video stores years ago, and yes, I'll admit it. But I watched The Bermuda Depths, which is a 1979... It's like a ghost story. Irving Berlin is the star, which is kind of weird. And Connie Selica, The Greatest American Hero, she's in it too. But it was very scary when I saw it way back when. She was Pam.
Okay.
It's a really interesting movie. It's called The Bermuda Depths. As far as I know, it's still not available anywhere. So I really wanted to preserve what I had. And I watched Barracuda, and I watched Piranha 2 The Spawning, God help me, which was as bad as I remember. And I watched Piranha 1995 with William Catt, who was also in The Greatest American Hero. And I watched The Philadelphia Experiment, which was a lot of fun. And reading, I've been doing a lot of non-genre, but the one thing I have read that is genre is New Ghost Stories 2 by the Fiction Desk. And I highly recommend that if you love ghost stories. They're out of England. The ghost stories are brilliant. They just have new takes on ghost stories, which surprise me every single time. And being the ghost story kind of slut that I am, it's really hard to get me to go, wow. And this stuff constantly surprises me. So other than that, I've been working on a couple of new short stories. And that's it. And studying for the aquarium, because I have to study every week. Otherwise, I don't remember. So that's what I've been doing.
Very good. Nice. Now, anybody want to mention any genre news? I know there's a few trailers that came out. Tron 3 came out. Sinister 2 came out.
Speaking of bad movies with good soundtracks.
Human Centipede 3 came out. Well, the first Sinister wasn't a bad movie.
No. I was talking about Tron 3. The Tron 2 was not a good film, but it had a great soundtrack.
Yeah, Tron 2. Oh. I own that soundtrack. It's awesome. High recommend. Okay. Yeah.
Really? Huh? I haven't seen any of those films, to be honest.
Yeah, the score is great. Yeah, the score is really good.
Nice. Now, I know on the Facebook group page, a lot of folks were mentioning how the Sinister 2 trailer isn't looking too good.
No, it looks bad.
Really?
Yeah.
Have not seen it. I somehow seem to be finding myself to be anti-trailer of late, and just because I guess I'm probably going to see this stuff anyway, I don't want to have an inkling how bad it is before I watch it.
Well, and I'm generally anti-trailer myself, but there's only so much you can do when you go to see a theater movie. Yeah, so I saw the trailer for Sinister 2, and it just looks like they're chewing every single piece of mythology they set up in the first one, and that doesn't work for me.
Mm.
Yeah, it looks like the cop is the lead, or at least one of the leads in the Sinister 2 based off of the trailer. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It looks like a completely different film than the first one, and it's more... it's not going to be as much of a mystery based off of what we show. It's like everybody knows there's this monster out there and we got to stop it type of thing rather than, trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
So those are the three, again, it was Human Centipede 3 trailer, Tron trailer, and Sinister trailer. And I only watched the Sinister 2 trailer myself. I haven't checked the other two out yet.
Can't say I really care about the other two.
Right.
Before I Wake, has anybody seen the trailer for that?
Nope.
No, not familiar with this one.
No, it's called Before I Wake, and they were showing that before It Follows, and it looks really good. It's like a family, and of course they adopt a little boy because their baby has died, and it's all these supernatural things. I mean, it's kind of derivative, but it just looks interesting. It looks sort of along the lines of The Possession, where they're doing a lot with symbolism with the butterflies and the moths, and I don't know, Before I Wake, it's called. Look it up. The trailer was just released. It's been released for like a month now, but that was just kind of interesting to me. That's the only thing I've seen of late that where I saw the trailer and went, ooh, I want to see that. Even if it might suck, I'm probably going to go check it out anyway.
Right. Yeah. I'll have to check that one out too. I'll probably find it and put a link up on Facebook. Group, the Dark Discussion Podcast Facebook group.
So, Mike, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
On the latest news on the remake front, I think I've established myself as fairly pro or at least open to remakes.
Yes.
But this one I don't quite get, and they're talking about remaking Cube.
Yeah, I saw that. It makes sense to me either. I don't understand what can be gained by a remake of that.
Money. Because nobody, it's not like this is a massive franchise. This was a very, very niche direct-to-video film in the first place.
From Canada.
And yes, I know it, and I know it had a couple of sequels that had mixed reviews, but this isn't like, you know, Friday the 13th or Poltergeist or Carrie. that's got this huge cash with the general public.
Well, what they're doing, Mike, is they see this film that is forgotten, except for maybe some genre fans like us, that was a pretty damn good film, and said, hey, why don't we remake this, you know, with Hollywood budget or whatever, and release it. Maybe that's what they're doing.
I just don't personally see how it can be better with a Hollywood budget. I thought they did fine the first time.
Right, it's not a concept that demands more and bigger. The idea is people stuck in a room, right. And then stuck in adjoining rooms. And
it also depends on if they're actually using it as a starring vehicle too. Because I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe they got someone that's semi-important to star, and then suddenly they think they can make a fortune off it. I don't know.
But even then, that doesn't make sense. You would want to put them in a star in a vehicle that would make sense to make them a star.
Well, here's the thing, though. This is really the way remakes should work, is by choosing a non-successful movie with a good concept and remaking it.
Like they did with
Trent. I just don't understand.
Well,
this one.
I would say there are the two ways for a remake is one is what you said, but that's a matter of salvaging a project that could have, pardon the pretension, some artistic merit, right? Because it was a good idea, it didn't work, right? The other thing would be to take a concept that was good and it would strictly be a marketing thing, was good for its time, people know it, people are going to willing to go see it, but that has elements that you can update and have a different relevance, or maybe can say something different with it in a modern context, right? And that's the other reason to remake or retell a story, is that you can update it for modern times. Nothing about Cube benefits from an update. It's not dated, in my opinion, in any way.
Right.
The concept that they talk about, about really self-driving bureaucracy and emergent behavior is just as relevant now, if not more so, than it was then.
I don't think that's the reason it's being remade. This is a guess, because I don't know anything about the remake. I don't know who's making it. I don't know if it's just another indie filmmaker remaking a film similar to, like, Martyrs, where that film's being remade, but it's not going to be a Hollywood film for sure. But this one here, I'm not sure. But my guess is that they're taking a film, an older film, so it's probably, what, 25 years, 20 years old by now, and saying, here's a good idea. Not many people know about it. Let's make it ours, release it, and we'll make some money off it.
Yeah, it's just that this is one of those things where it's such an obscure film, relatively speaking.
But again, I don't think they care about the original and any fan base for the original. What I think they care about is that, here's a good idea. Let's make it now, release it with some sort of marketing, and people will like it, and we can make some money.
I don't know. I still have a feeling this is not going to be done as a budget film that's going to get released in theaters with a marketing push behind it. Maybe I'm wrong, but
then it could be a piece for a director to show off, someone to make a name for themselves.
Yeah, but again, why pick this project? There are so many projects in Hollywood that have never been filmed. There are so many. Every year they release lists of the best scripts that nobody's produced. It's not the fact that Hollywood is lacking for original material. The reason they go to the franchises is because it's got a marketing, built-in marketing awareness to it. You know, there's a reason why they turned Psycho and Hannibal into TV series, because people are familiar with those concepts.
Yeah, but and also a lot. There's, again, though, I see you keep on going back to that, and I'm going to go back to the other thing, which is someone saying, "Let's go back, find an obscure film that was really well, that had a really well made screenplay, and let's use that and make it brand new today." So,
but I don't understand why, Phil. That's what I'm saying. I don't understand why they were doing it that way, because there's not a shortage of original. Because there's not a shortage of original material. The reason they go back is for marketing, pure and simple.
Because Hollywood sucks. Let's move on.
And right, it's not like so.
Well, either way, I still see people taking like songs, for example. Musicians find these obscure songs that someone made that or wrote that didn't do anything, and then they make it their own, and it becomes a number one hit. I mean, it's
that
the same
has happened
thing.
More than once.
Yeah, and so here's the same thing. It's like here's a great film that no one knows about. Let's remake
except,
it.
Except making a song takes a lot less involvement in most cases than remaking a film.
I'm not disagreeing with it. It's just that, I mean, if that's your median, then you're going to do it as a film versus, say, a song. But it's the same idea generally, even if one is a little easier or less expensive. But either way, let's move on. We'll see what happens and hear more news about it as we go. Any further news items? Anything?
No.
All right. So let's get into our topic. So, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are discussing Guillermo del Toro's Spanish-language film, Pan's Labyrinth.
In a dark time, when hope was bleak, there lived a young girl whose only escape was in a legend that wanted her back. The legend speaks of the lost soul of a princess from another world who will one day be reborn. There will be signs that mark her return. There will be secrets that reveal her destiny. There will be a journey that will make you believe.
Said a contest winner. Basically, what we did, me, Eric, Mike, and Abe chose two films each. We put them up on the Facebook page in a poll. Didn't say who chose what film, and let listeners or members of the podcast page vote for what movie would we like the crew to do. And Abe, I think you chose Pan's Labyrinth as your film, and that was the one that won that poll, and that's why we're doing Pan's Labyrinth. And as Eric said, it's Del Toro. So this is, I think, the third thing by Del Toro that Dark Discussions has now done an episode on. The first was his Pacific Rim. The second is his television show, The Strain. And now this here.
You guys did an episode on Mama, but I believe he produced that.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Technically.
Yeah, technically, I think.
That's actually a good point. Yeah, so he did produce that, so that you could argue that's one we did as well. The film is a 2006 film. It's supposed to be a co-Spain and co-Mexico production. Doesn't surprise me because the topic is of Spain, and the person behind the film is from Mexico. And
Guillermo del Toro actually refused better funding for this movie that was tied to making it English language. So he could have made this movie with a bigger budget if he'd made it English language, but he refused to do that.
That is interesting. It did win 3 Academy Awards either way, mostly for technical things. And it was highly received by most critics and most fans that actually saw it as well. And it definitely does have a Del Toro feel, which is more of like a fantasy, whimsical type of thing.
A really depressing, whimsical.
Yeah. In the term of the dark fantasy, this is bleakest, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. You could even argue that the whole fantasy was fantasy only for the fact that it was in a person's mind, because there's arguments for this film that some people say that none of it actually happened.
It's less of an interpretation kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so, this is also, I think, if I can interrupt here for a second, of all of his films, I mean, I was a big fan of The Orphanage. I've seen a lot of his work. This is one of the films that I think he most heavily draws from magic realism, not the writing magic realism that I've talked about in the past with like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who was a writer, but the artistic side of magic realism, which started in Germany right after World War I. And there's a lot of imagery and stuff in this film that does kind of relate to that. In addition to pulling from fairy tales, this film has been overanalyzed to death. If you Google it on the internet, there's millions of people talking about it. But I didn't read anything before I saw it, and I have never seen it before I had to watch it to discuss it with you guys tonight. Which
really?
Was kind of neat. Yeah.
Wow.
Which was neat.
Okay.
Because I just went into it totally blind and no hype, and I just said, I just want to see what I get out of this. But there's a lot of artistically, like in terms of fine art, magic realism elements that he brings into it, which I'm not surprised by, because that's just kind of the way his other work also goes. Like the mandrake root, that's a very magic realist image. Mm-hmm. That particular thing, you know, when it's crying in the bowl of milk, that's a very, very heavily magic realism.
I'm shocked. I am absolutely shocked that as a fan of horror films, you have gone so long neglecting a classic, especially as a fan of Del Toro. I can't believe you have not seen this film until recently.
Nope. It was one of those things where, to be honest, there was so much hype around it when it came out. And for me, if there's that much hype around something, whether it's horror or it's whatever, I tend to shy away from it unless something in a trailer sparks me. Like, unless I see a trailer and I go, oh my God, that looks good. Like, Unfriended. There was a lot of hype around Unfriended. But I saw the trailer and I went, oh my God, okay, I'm going to try this. I remember when Pan's Labyrinth came out and everybody in my office at my day job was like, Chrissy, you got to go see this movie. And then I would see the trailers on TV and I'd go, okay, but this doesn't look like something I would enjoy. So whether it's Guillermo del Toro or not, it doesn't look like something that's going to float my boat. So I'm going to avoid it. However, I think waiting all this time actually made me appreciate it more, because I'm so separated from that. You know, there's no hype around it now. And now there's a lot of interesting stuff to read about it on the internet. So it was far more fascinating to me.
Well, I had an interesting experience when I saw this in the theater when it first came out, because at that point, while being a fan of horror movies, I wasn't, I hadn't discovered the horror circles on the internet yet. And the people I was hanging out with at the time weren't really big horror fans. And actually somebody I knew's girlfriend suggested that we go see this movie because she'd heard really good things about it. And she actually tricked us, didn't tell us that it was a Spanish language movie. Because her boyfriend hated subtitled movies and would have refused to go see it if he'd known. So she tricked us.
I'm going to guess that relationship probably did not last.
Yeah.
Well, you're right.
Well, not because he doesn't like subtitled films, but because she would trick him into doing that. You know,
right,
I,
right.
I
But anyway. I didn't know a damn thing going into it, and it ended up being an incredible movie. And it just it kind of hit me like a punch to the gut, because I just had no idea what I was walking into.
Yeah, well, that's what was funny, because Mike, my husband or whoever it was that just said, "I'm shocked you didn't see this," had a similar reaction, because I said, "Philip invited me to do Pan's Labyrinth," and Nathan said, "Oh, so you're going to do it?" And I said, "Yeah, I've never seen it." And there's this dead silence, and my husband looks at me and goes, "You never saw Pan's Labyrinth?" He goes, "What's wrong with you?" I go, "I told him the same thing. I told you." And he goes, "So what is wrong with you?" I'm like, "I don't know. It just, you know, but I think it was a much more enriching experience for me waiting all this time, because I wasn't."
When did you actually catch up with it?
You mean when did I actually watch it?
Yes.
Yeah, today.
This afternoon.
Oh, this afternoon. Oh, okay.
For the very first time. And it was amazing. I was sitting at work watching it at my desk on the computer. It was amazing. I was like, I should have seen this years ago. Everybody was right. But with all due respect, sometimes people at work, you know, when 50 Shades of Grey, the book came out, they were saying, read 50 Shades of Grey, read 50 Shades of Grey. So, you know, I got to take everything they take with a grain of salt. And if they start saying, go see this, I really do think about it two or three times and go, you know, maybe not. And like I said, the trailers didn't appeal to me. But then once Philip said, you know, we're going to do it, and I was like, yeah, this would be a great time for me to sit down and watch it. I bought the DVD outright. Wow, I'm sold. I got to watch this thing four or five more times because it's amazing. But I think having that distance probably improved my experience. I don't know how impressed I would have been with it when I was, you know, 10 years younger. I don't know if it would have had, I think my life experience greatly informed what I was seeing, if that makes any sense. 10 Yep. years ago, I was not the same person that I am today. And I don't think I would have gotten as much out of it 10 years ago. So everything happens for a reason.
Well, yeah, and the older they get, the more you realize that life is unfair, and that's kind of how this movie hits you. So,
yeah, it's really, yeah, it was very moving to me. And 10 years ago, I might have been sitting there going, okay. You know, it's more Pan and medieval stuff and mythology stuff. I don't think I would have appreciated it on the level that I did today. Today, it really hit me like a ton of bricks. So,
now, Mike and Abe, what were your guys' opinion of the film? Obviously, it appears that Eric and Christy enjoyed it. What about you, Abe?
I really love this movie. I was first introduced to it. Like, I've seen the advertisements for it before its release. I never went to any theater to see it. But I first saw it when my folks decided to watch it in, on the TV one time. And I caught a glimpse of it before I found a chance to watch it on my own. And, you know, it's a gorgeous film. I love its really its atmosphere. It's definitely a very artistic film. As I said before, it's certainly one of Del Toro's bleakest. I mean, he does some dark films, but this one, I mean, this one was like on a different level from those. In terms of the dark fantasy, you know, I mean, because some of them had like others had some like lighter moments, but this one I remember one moment of relief, to be honest.
Right. And Abe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I know you're a big fan of makeup and creature effects. Is that part of the appeal of this movie to you?
Oh yeah, I mean the creature effects are astounding. I mean they're really top notch. Especially one scene that I found to be one of my favorites, which is the Pale Man scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. What about you, Mike?
Well, I'm a fan of Del Toro, so I couldn't wait to see this movie. And I saw it all the way back on April 6th. Because
You've never seen this film until...
I had never seen the movie up until a month ago, because what had happened is I got married.
Yep.
And I've had this film on Blu-ray for a long, long time. Yep. And I wanted to watch it. And Pam wanted to watch it. So I waited to watch it. I said, do you want to watch Pan's Labyrinth? Well, I have to work. I can't do subtitles. Okay. Do you want to watch it now? I want to Facebook. We can't do subtitles. How about now? No subtitles. How about now? No subtitles. What do you want to know? No subtitles. What do you want to know? No subtitles. And I didn't want to watch it because she wanted to watch it too. And so I got kind of put in the pile of Pam's films for Pam and Mike to finally watch. And then Abe put it down and it won. And like, I have leverage to bring it back out of the bottom of the pile, blow the dust off of it.
Honey, I have to watch this before such and such date.
Right, exactly. I was like, now, can we watch? Because we have to do an episode on it. And I know you're going to listen to it, and you're going to ask, well, can we watch it now? Because you did an episode on it. And I knew, and I also knew, well, what didn't want her, like, saying, why did you watch it without me? You knew I wanted to see the movie, and you did an episode. And it's like, it's been 10 years. It's been 10 years.
Well, you know what? Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, it's been 9 years. It is, again, amazing. It's been that old. So, anyway, I've mentioned many times on the podcast that while I not like everything Del Toro has necessarily done, I do generally like his style. And I generally like his stuff and will, at the moment, always give it a shot. And I really like this film. It is a beautiful film. It's something I probably want to revisit at some point, because there is a lot kind of going on. It is sort of a dark Spanish Wizard of Oz, right? When you get into that whole, is it real? Is it not real?
To say that there's a lot going on is an understatement. Like, you nailed it. You could study this film for months and never figure it all out. It's just got so much going on.
And a lot of it's open-ended, really, to be honest. Because, honestly, no matter how much you dig into it, there's going to be answers that you're never going to get because it could be just a different interpretation from someone else entirely.
Right. And just like in Wizard of Oz, there are characters where there are, in the fantasy realm, that have a direct analogy in the real world. Mm-hmm. A direct counterpart, although they're not played by the same actor as in The Wizard of Oz.
Alice in Wonderland, for that.
Or Alice in Wonderland. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff I missed because I just am not up on my Spanish history, not really up on most of my European history, to be honest. Because when I took that section of high school...
You were stoned?
No, absolutely not. But actually, we were nerdy.
No, but I was, so I can make the excuse. I was.
Well, no. See, we had Mr. Barnett was my 10th grade history teacher, and he's great guy. Loved him. One of my favorite teachers. But he made a mistake of indulging the students, and whatever questions we'd ask, we'd get into conversations. Mm-hmm. And so, by the time the rest of the school was like covering World War II, we still hadn't made it to the Renaissance. and fortunately for us, I'm sorry to say, but fortunately, he had a heart attack like the last week of school.
Aww.
He survived, which is why I can say fortunately. But that meant we couldn't do any review for the final exam, so our final exam got to be open book.
All right, where's this going?
So my point was that there's this whole section of like, you know, actual European history, especially more recent European history, that I never covered, that I never learned, and I never took any history courses in college, despite an interest in doing it. So I have a lot of blind spots. And so, like, the whole thing with the Spanish Civil War, I know next to nothing about, and there may be all sorts of things in here that I am sure, because Del Toro also already set, what was the movie? Devil's Backbone, right? Wasn't that in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War?
So he loves that period.
And there are things that will have that I'm sure have resonance in this story that are going completely past me. I'm guessing. Well,
he does talk about in the commentary that this is a spiritual, not sequel. That's not the word he used. He used it was a spiritual successor to his film, The Devil's Backbone, which I have not seen, But after seeing Pan Labyrinth today, oh no, I ordered it. It's coming. It'll be here on Saturday or whatever. Cause I had no idea. My first introduction to Del Toro was The Orphanage, which I absolutely fell
in love. Also a good movie.
He produced that one.
Yeah, loved it. Loved it. Actually, my husband and I think it was before Pan's Labyrinth came out. Correct me if I'm wrong. Because I might be wrong.
I think you're wrong, actually.
Was it after that? That was my first exposure to him. And we went down to New York City and saw it at the premiere. And we brought a couple of dear friends of ours who are also writers. And we just licked this film up. Like, The Orphanage is one of my favorite films of all time. And so if Pan's Labyrinth came afterward, I may not have connected it with the same guy. But you know what I mean? But he talks a lot about his, you know, how The Devil's Backbone, if you truly want to appreciate Pan's Labyrinth, you have to see The Devil's Backbone first. And in fact, the mother in Pan's Labyrinth, whose name is Carmen, the main character, the protagonist female in The Devil's Backbone is also named Carmen. So I'm very curious to see if they're actually kind of supposed to be the same woman, but just later in life. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. I found nothing in my research to indicate that they're the same character, but I found it interesting that he named them the same. So I don't know if as an artist, maybe he had a beloved named Carmen that he just, cause sometimes writers do that. You know, they'll have every female character will be the same frickin' name, even though they're different people. I don't know. I didn't have time today to check that out, but I'm interested. And I only got halfway through the commentary. I want to finish the rest of the commentary to see what he has to say. But that was just kind of interesting. So I ordered The Devil's Backbone, and I will be watching that this weekend because I can't wait now.
All right. Now, everybody, now hold really on to your hat. Hold on to your hat.
Yeah.
Bill, what do you think of this movie?
Well, first off, The Orphanage that Christy mentioned, I did not like that film. The last 10 minutes just ruined it for me. Though I have to agree with you, Christy. It was very good up to the last 10 minutes.
I do agree with you, actually. The last 10 minutes sucked.
Yeah, I cannot believe
it. I'll come out and say it. It totally ruined the film. I was like, why did he do that? But he did that with Mama, too. So, whatever.
Right,
anyway, go on. Yeah.
Sure. For this film here, I was going into it, I guess, differently. I wasn't expecting the magical realism or the potential that the protagonist was a unreliable narrator. So when I saw this film way back, as I bought it the day it came out on DVD, so that must have been either 2006 or early 2007, I was not a big fan of the film. I see what he was doing. I didn't like the political aspect of the film for the fact that both sides of that civil war, even though this is post the war, right after the war, it had ended the civil war, were both bad folks, in my opinion, and based off of what I've read, where the leftists massacred priests and things like that, just as we see in this film here, the right-wing groups did their own terrible thing. So I did not like how the film portrayed Spain at that time and what had happened. So that I was already kind of upset with that when I first saw the film. And you realize
that's only like the backdrop, right? That's not actually what the movie's about.
Again, he didn't have to make this film as a backdrop of the Spanish Civil War. Obviously that's an important thing for him, because he has made a number of films, as we discussed, in that time period and about that war and in the perspective of one side. So, doing that, he chose to do that. He wrote this screenplay, so he chooses to do that. So either way, it was heavy on me when I watched it, I thought. I know it wasn't for Eric. For the magical realism, I'm not as huge into fantasy, and I don't really call Game of Thrones truly fantasy. So even though I love Game of Thrones, so this didn't work for me as well as, someone who likes this type of, I guess, story, the mysticism and whatnot. I've always been a love-hate for Del Toro's films. I love the Hellboy films. I love The Strain. This film, I was at the first time I watched it, I didn't enjoy it that well. I did, you know, rewatching it, it is better each time, so I can see that it's growing, similar to like the first time I saw it, like Sixth Sense, for example, I didn't really like, but then the second time I thought it was great. Same with Zack Snyder's, what the hell's the zombie film, Zack Snyder's zombie film?
Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead. Yeah, I didn't like it the first time I watched it, but then the second time I loved it. So this is a film that is kind of growing on me like that. And now that I know what type of it is, because I was going in expecting a horror film, and it really wasn't a horror film that I thought it was going to be. So I probably.
What do you mean? The leftist won.
No, they actually,
no, it was the fascist one.
Yeah, the fascist one, right, versus the communist. So, you know, flip a coin, which is worse. But, yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the film. I do appreciate it and liked it the second time watching it, but in no way I would say that it's one of my favorite films. So that's where I'm at on the film.
Well, I think too, with a film like this, like I had just seen it for the first time today. And after I was done watching it, I did some research and, you know, I had watched documentaries on things and things on Del Toro before because of the other films I have of his on DVD and stuff like that. So I kind of have an understanding of a little bit of what he's attracted to and what's interesting. And the thing with Pan's Labyrinth is that I think, you know, Mike hit it. Was it Mike? Was it you who said there's so much going on here? There is so much, or maybe it was Eric. Or Abe, one of you said it. There is so much going on in this film. One of you did. There is mm-hmm. so much going on here. Mm-hmm. This is a thesis waiting to happen. And if you Google it, which is what I did, I just said, just for shits and giggles, let me Google Pan's Labyrinth and what it means. I found so much material on, you know, like academic papers on the level of mythology, the level of all the themes. There's about 8 surface themes that are going on here. There's like a very obvious birth theme, obviously, where there's imagery of the uterus everywhere and all this kind of stuff. There's so much stuff out there. And so this is one of those films that I think the reason it won all these awards, honestly, is because it focused so much on mythology that is all part of our collective unconscious, that maybe we're not all educated in mythology, but for example, the Pale Man, that a lot of our horror fans really loved because they said, oh, the Pale Man, the Pale Man. Well, the Pale Man is actually a version of an ogre. And it goes back to Germany, it goes back to Norway, it goes back to Icelandic tales, it goes back to Greek mythology. It goes back to, yeah. Exactly, but it's the collective.
But it's like the witch in the woods in Hansel and Gretel, right? The thing that's going to eat the little children, because that's a primal fear that we still have. Is even though we've been at the top of the food chain for a long time, we still have that fear of being eaten, and that's why we have Jaws as a film.
Mm. Yeah,
well, go ahead, Christy.
No, finish. Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, even if you remove all the mythology elements from it, the film still connects on an emotional level. I saw this movie with my friend Dan, who's my co-host on the Ascansity podcast, and anybody who listens to that knows that Dan is a very manly man. He likes to lift heavy things, and football is all about hurting people and everything like this. And when we got out of Pan's Labyrinth, he was pissed off. Because that movie made him cry.
Well, and that's the other thing, too. There are such... He keys into such primal things in this movie at a very basic level. Here's a little girl. Here's a girl whose life around her is so horrible that she escapes into fantasy. And whether or not the fantasy is really real is up for debate. because right. it might just be the place where she ran. And then when she dies at the end, spoiler alert, by the way, when she dies at the end, that might have been her heaven that she went to, where her right. mom is the queen. Is the same actress who's playing her mom. Well, I think.
I was going to ask that question to everybody at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. Well, I haven't checked,
I read something. I read something that apparently Del Toro said that everything that happens was actually real.
Well, that's right. what he says, but I'm still saying that it's wasn't.
Open.
It was just her way to
get it. It is open to interpretation because at the very beginning of the movie, you get a shot of her lying on the ground, bleeding. We don't know why yet. And it kind of zooms into her eye as the narration starts the whole story of the mythology. Yeah. And at the very end, we get that same shot again.
So, yeah, I mean, this film takes a lot from Slaughterhouse-5, which is similar, where it may all be in the guy's head. And then at the end, you can determine whether or not you think he was just imagining it or not. It takes the point, like you just said, Eric, like Jacob's Ladder, where...
Right.
He's at his death thing, and the whole thing's happening as he's dying. I mean, it's the same idea. And
spoiler warning. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, spoiler.
That's true. So
yeah, but I mean, I think go ahead, Phil.
I was
just going to say, getting back to Eric's point about connecting on an emotional level. You know, here's a girl who has lost her mom. Her mom is dying, carrying another child. The mother eventually passes away. That's a very intense thing. And having gone through that in the real world, when I was very young, losing my mother at a young age, I can connect with the whole, this is a horrible illness my mother's going through, because in the beginning of the film, Ophelia is very much more the adult. And as her mother gets sicker and sicker, she regresses into this place that is safer for her, even if it's a scary monster. And a lot of people, I think, even if they haven't been through the same experience I have, can identify with that because it's terrifying. It's terrifying to lose your parents at any age. Cause guess what? You're next. Like, I'm sorry, you're next. Like right. once they go, you're next.
Well, and I said that just to somebody for the fact that you're quote unquote possibly alone too, right?
And you're alone and you have no guidance and you have nowhere to go. And that's very terrifying for a child. So I think one of the reasons that this film might have become the massive success that it was because it actually touches things that maybe we can't articulate, but we all sort of know as humans. We all are afraid of it. No, we don't sit around and dwell on it, but it's there. The only people who dwell on that are the people it's actually happened to. But once it's happened to you, it's like, oh, my God, the light comes on. And I think that's why it kind of hit such a chord. And, like, it's very bleak. And that's why. Because that's what life looks like that when that happens. And he managed to tap into a kind of a, I don't know, like some sort of message that was a message but not beating you over the head with it, if that makes any sense, too. It was very subtle.
Yeah.
And I would agree that it was subtle, specifically for the fact that at points we actually think it's happening. It's only near the end when you suddenly debate whether or not it's in her mind or not at her deathbed or whatever.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And that's the point where you can start saying, oh, okay, put things together. But up to that point, meaning the very end, it is in a sense subtle and such, but I don't know. It's an interesting film because it really, even though we've mentioned Wizard of Oz, Alice in Wonderland, Slaughterhouse-5, Jacob's Ladder, various other films that have done it, if not the same way, the general like idea, if you boil away everything, it is its own unique
flavor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very, very unique.
Well, and that's the thing with magic realism, at least on the artistic side rather than the writing side. Magic realism reminds us that we don't always understand what we're looking at. You know, we don't always understand what something really means until we stop and think about it and we can relate to it in our own lives. And that once we go deeper, there are lots of mysteries in life that we might never understand. And that's the beauty of this film. I think it is actually speaking to the tenet of that. Like, we don't really know what's going to happen. We don't know what goes beyond death. I mean, like you said, it's okay. He said everything that happened is real, but what is real really? Is real in our own experience?
Oh yeah, God.
There we go. Philosophy.
Let's not go there.
Let's all go there. But
actually, and to be honest, yeah. Christy, you have a good point there because, on our episode Ex Machina, me, Mike, and Eric were discussing what makes something sentient. And Mike said that you don't know if I'm really sentient. And I said, yeah, I do because you're a human. And Mike says, yeah, but who says I'm sentient? You know, it's like the sound, if no one's there, does the tree make a sound when it hits the, you know, so there's existential things, a lot of existential things here.
It's a lot of existentialism. Yeah. And I think as human beings, and I think we can all agree, we all go through that. We all question ourselves every day. Are we really here? Are we, you know, whatever. I took a lot of philosophy courses in college. They were very boring, but that is one thing I got out of it.
You know? So,
that I should always question whether or not I'm really here. Excellent.
Before we begin, let me just give a quick synopsis of the film. It's basically 1944 in Spain, after what happened was the Spanish Civil War, and there was the communists and the fascists fought basically to take over the country. So Spain was in trouble no matter who won. And what happened was that the fascist won, which actually was probably good for the rest of the world because as a result – Franco, who became the leader, decided to remain neutral in World War II and refused to join up with the Nazis, and unlike the Italians and El Duce there, he decided to join Hitler. So it kept Spain out of the war. Now, what happened here in this film is basically the war, Civil War has ended, though World War II is still being fought. And basically, Franco's government is basically solidifying power and putting the structure in place, just as any winner of any civil war would happen. And so this is what's happening now. And as a result, there's a group of leftists that are still out there, or communists that are still out there, still trying to gain power, so running, doing a guerrilla war, basically. And we're here with this child, a little girl, with her mother, that's pregnant, as you said, Christy, who's dying, married to a commander. I don't know how high up he is, but a commander in the fascist leadership.
They call him a captain.
Yeah, so he's a peewee in the real scheme of the Spanish government, but he has a general power in this area of the country.
I think this is part is that this is not about the large scale. This is not about Franco. This is about a small scale. What's happening in this place?
Yeah,
this, and what matters, for example, to the girl has nothing to do with the politics of the left or the right. It's that the captain is an asshole.
Right. I agree.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this is her stepfather, and basically what it is whether he's a fascist or a communist or just, you know, a farmer down the street, the problem is he a good man or a bad man to her? And it appears, based off of this film, he's a bad guy.
That's an understatement, Phil. That is such an understatement.
Right, but that's right. Fair enough. It's understatement. So what happens here is that she begins to go into this world, as you stated, Christy, like a dark fantasy world, and there's trials and tribulations there, and then there's we'll get into specific scenes. We mentioned Pale Man and a few other items and such, and then at the end of the film, there's the twist, quote unquote twist, is did it really actually happen, or was this just her escape from the terrible situation of her mother dying and the abuse she's getting from this scumbag captain guy. And is there any further, this was just a synopsis. So is there anything else? Did I miss anything?
No, that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
No, I think that's pretty fair. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, now what do we want to begin? What do we want to talk about? We should probably going to talk about, various scenes too. So do we want to talk about various scenes and then relate to the, all this other stuff that we're talking about, the existential stuff against those scenes? Like, what is the Paleon? What is that whole purpose of that? Or the Satyr or whatever the creature is.
I think that might be a good idea.
The Fawn, right. All right. So let's do that. Eric, where do you want to begin? Since we don't have too much longer, we have about another 30 minutes or so, 35 minutes.
Oh, really, Phil? You might have to make this a little longer.
Yeah, there you go. What scenes do we want to discuss? There's the real scenes, obviously, with her and her mother and the evil man. And then there's these scenes. Why don't you give us the scene that introduces us to how she gets into the fantasy world?
Oh, Jesus. I don't remember which scene that is.
No, it doesn't matter. I mean, Chrissy, you saw the film today. Maybe you could do a better job. I don't know.
Yes. In the opening, I'll keep this very short. In the opening, we see her and her pregnant mother going into the Spanish woods. They're going to a military outpost, and basically her mom is carrying the baby, the son, basically, of this sociopathic guy. Who is the captain? I would even go a little further. I would even say he's a psychopath, but whatever. I don't think he's a sociopath as much because they're a little bit more, but he's pretty bad. But anyway, they're going there and the mom has been sick. There's an interesting translation in the subtitles, which says she is sick with baby, you know?
So right. Yeah.
The mother is, yeah, which was very interesting to me. So well, the mother is constantly on the verge of throwing up, and yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just as a note, Guillermo del Toro did the translation on this movie himself because he had bad experiences with translators previously.
Yeah, and I think it's beautiful the way he translated it because he basically made the point.
Yep.
She is sick with baby, which yes. If you think about that line, that's loaded. Oh my God, that's loaded. You could take that 5,000 different ways. It is loaded. But anyway, she, you know, the mother gets sick and pulls it. They have to pull the cars over. And, you know, basically she is taunted by this bug, which looks like a leaf. I guess, Mike, what do they call those? Stick bugs?
Yeah, it's a stick insect. They're related to, they're in the mantid family. Odonata, I think. No, those are dragonflies. Shit.
Yeah,
anyway.
but it's like.
But yeah, they're in the same basic family as mentioned. But it's a stick insect of some type.
And so the stick bug sort of follows her to this place, and then as she's looking at her book, because it's established that she loves books and all this, it becomes the shape of a fairy, and it turns into a fairy. And so this fairy then leads her to the labyrinth, which is in the back of this old mill. And that's where she meets the Pan character. So that's how it kind of starts off. And that's how this whole thing gets going. So.
Well, I think it's interesting is that they didn't, and actually I kind of prefer an alternate, is that they don't refer to him, I think, as Pan in the Spanish, right? He's just referred to as the Fawn.
No, the Fawn, yes. And even Del Toro said in his commentary, they translated it in English to Pan, but it's not supposed to be Pan.
Yeah,
Pan is loaded.
The Spanish title of the mode is El Laberinto del Fauno, which
I'm
assuming
the Labyrinth of the Fawn or whatever it is. Yeah, so it's not.
Yeah, and I actually prefer. I mean, if it was the English translation had been the Fawn's Labyrinth, I kind of prefer that title for some reason. Maybe because I carry too much of Greek mythology over with the name Pan.
Well, exactly. And if you look at labyrinth is interesting too. The word labyrinth is interesting because, you know, if you go into the original, like, first look at the word labyrinth, the original meaning of the labyrinth was it was a huge maze and it was constructed by King Minos, I think, in Crete.
Yeah, the House of Minotaur in the legend.
Exactly. And it was the House of the Minotaur. Exactly right. And there's a theory that has been proposed by archaeologists that this labyrinth, which they claim to have found pieces of, whatever, who knows, was actually the secret palace. So that kind of makes sense while Del Toro chose a labyrinth. Why didn't he choose a cave? Why did he not choose like a hollow in a tree? But then when you listen to the commentary, Del Toro says, I chose a labyrinth because a labyrinth always has a way out. A maze does not. And I wanted to put that choice because this main character, Ophelia, which is also loaded, by the way, that's just a loaded name, because of Hamlet, even though that was way right after Greek mythology, it's all loaded. And he was like, I wanted her to make a choice. And if I used maze, that kind of implies that there might not be a choice. But in a labyrinth, there's always a choice. There is never a dead end in a labyrinth. And that was in an interview that it was very interesting. That was in an interview that I read with him. But it's just kind of cool because then I was thinking she needs to find her true self. And what did monks do? You know, monks in medieval times, they drew like labyrinths, even though they weren't surrounded by hedges like in The Shining. They drew labyrinths, like with ink or whatever, on the concrete. And they followed them when they were doing their prayers because it was a way of finding yourself and there was never a dead end. So, you know, anyway, I'll be quiet now. That was just my thoughts on that. But yeah.
That's interesting thoughts, though.
We didn't have you on the show to be quiet, Christy.
And I know, but still, it's like kind of cool to me that Del Toro was like associating with that. He's like, I could have chosen something else. I could have just said it was a maze. And it's weird because nobody ever explains in the movie why it's even there in the first place, which I also think is kind of really cool. What the hell is it doing there? Like, really, it's just this labyrinth in the middle of nowhere, and then there's like an explanation about portals or something, but I'm like, okay, but how did it get to the human world?
Well, and nobody at the end of the movie seems to question that it's there either, so.
No, nobody asks, which is actually genius, because you don't want to get too complicated.
Right.
If you have to explain everything, you're going too far. I mean, me as a writer, I can say that. Some things you just don't say. You let it go. Let people figure it out on their own. Unless it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it makes sense. So.
Right.
All right. Now, did we want to start talking about some of the monsters in the film and what they mean? I think when people think of this film or see posters or clips of this film, they think or see
of the Pale Man.
Yeah, the Pale Man specifically. Yeah. And a few other things. That's all right. Who did that? No big deal. So
no, that was me.
Oh, don't that tell me you spilled wine.
No, I did not spill wine. That was my husband's beer bottles from his show on Sunday night. And they're all, yeah.
It happens. So yeah, Eric.
He leaves them here and I haven't cleaned them up yet. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. So Eric, you brought up the Peel Man. What's that all about?
Well, first, before we get there, I just want to say that I think real quickly we should get into the real plot and the fantasy plot a little bit. Just to give a broad outline of what happens. The real plot in a real world is that the mom is sick and pregnant. The captain has a doctor on staff that is looking after the wife. This doctor is actually part of the resistance locally, as is what's her face? Is she a housekeeper? Is that her
Mercedes.
Position? Mercedes.
Yeah, Mercedes. And she's like head of household. She's like head mistress. She kind of oversees the staff.
So both of the doctor and the headmistress are part of the resistance, unknown to the captain. And that's what's going on in the real world. And in fantasy world, the girl gets talked to by this fairy who leads her to the faun. And the faun says, oh, you're actually a princess, but we need to verify who you are. If you're the princess, you'll be able to perform these three tasks before the full moon without a problem. So here's your first task. Go do it.
Yes.
Hello. I'll give you the next one.
Yeah. And, you know, the first one was, if I remember, it was a massive toad under a tree that she had to retrieve, I think it was a key from. By and she tricked it into meeting some stones given to her by the faun. I was This one was, I know a lot about the symbolism of the Pale Man, but this one was a little hard to figure out, unless it was just a fantasy moment without much to it. I mean, did anyone pick up anything about the toad?
I got nothing.
Yeah, see, toad was just, oh, you got something, Mike?
I'm just thinking now, see, because this was like one of my, for me, my clues that there might have been a mixture of fantasy and reality, because it's the key, and they'd already made a significant point about the key to the I don't know exactly where this falls, and if it was right after this or right before this, that you have the key to the storage and the supplies. So I don't know. Right. And I don't know how it ties into fantasy. I know in biology that I see a toad or a frog, and it's really just a mouth and a stomach. It's a gluttonous animal. Which made it great for feeding demonstrations, but I don't know if there's some sort of mythology about toads being gluttonous creatures. So the idea that it's the idea of the glutton hoarding something, and maybe that you have, you know, the hoarding of the supplies. I don't know if that's a thing, but that's just the only thing that pops into my head.
Yeah. No, that's a definite. I think that is a definite connection, because she even says to the toad, "You're killing this tree." And you don't care, or something along those lines. She's like, you're sitting under here being gluttonous with these bugs, or whatever she says. It's something like that. She addresses the toad. She says, I am not afraid of you. And aren't you ashamed? That's what she says. She says, aren't you ashamed? Sitting here eating all these bugs and getting fat when the tree is dying. That's a direct reference to the gluttony of, we can go political with this, maybe with the difference between the fascists and the nationalists or whatever, but it's a direct reference to, you are stealing everything from the people, don't you care?
Okay. Now that actually makes sense now. Okay, awesome.
I mean, he never said that anywhere, but that was kind of what I got out of it, but.
No, it actually makes more sense when you think about it. Yeah. See, the toe is the hard pickup on. For me, at least. It was, especially consider how quick the scene was.
Well, and yet, both sides of the conflict were greedy in their own ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a commentary on war, if you think about it. But whatever.
Right. Well, see, and this is always why I want to be careful. I don't always agree with the politics of the stories or of the storytellers and the stories I'm watching, but a lot of times we all interpret events differently, and we interpret sides of a political conflict differently. And, you know, for example, you know, Phil's issue with the left and how it's portrayed in this, you certainly see that reflected, that it's, we may not get it necessarily from the Spanish perspective, but we certainly can see more of it in the United States and how we deal with Cuba, and that, you know, some people like idolize the Castros or Che Guevara, and others despise them. So you know that those politics will sometimes inform how certain events are portrayed in a story, especially when you're getting into metaphor. Here, you know, yeah, you're right. You can certainly argue there was bad things on both sides, although it's, you know, Del Toro's telling a very basic story from the point of view of the other side. Mostly is obviously, for whatever reason, sympathetic to the communist side in the Civil War.
Right.
And also toads and frogs, too. Toads and frogs traditionally in mythology also represent the idea of beauty and ugliness.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you kiss the toad and he turns into a prince.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot going on there that you could probably talk about for hours, too. But that's, you know, that was also another very interesting thing to me, in that she has to go in and take the key, the golden key out of the belly of the toad, which is sort of like, okay, she's
the beauty inside the ugly.
Yes, exactly. So that was kind of interesting too.
Okay.
So, yeah, and the advantage here with the metaphor is that we can argue and you can disagree with which side was the gluttonous side, but because it's a metaphor and because it's a toad, it doesn't matter what Del Toro believes of who is gluttonous. It's simply the fact that we all agree that gluttony is bad. It's just, who do we ascribe the gluttony to?
Yes, so, and that's part of his brilliance. I don't think he was actually coming out in this film, I don't know what his political leanings are. I really don't know. And the fact that I could watch this film and watch him make a statement and not know which side he was on gets points in my book. Because I'm like, he's making a comment without being... He's making a comment on humanity. You know,
well,
he's
not just I don't like, know. Yeah. He was pretty clearly portraying the captain as the bad guy.
Right, but the advantage here, and again, this is maybe being separated from it and being distanced from it and not, you know, being immersed in the history of the Spanish Civil War. There really isn't a lot in terms of political ideology thrown at you.
No.
You don't have the rebels that are being hunted down. You don't hear them talking about, you know, the capitalist pigs and how we must overthrow them. You don't get a lot about, you know, the fascists talking about, you know, their stuff. It's the you have two sides, and the commandant is an asshole because he's an asshole, not because he's a fascist necessarily.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
And you don't even say, and because he's an asshole, all the fascists are assholes. That would be an extrapolation. Not necessarily an unfair one if you want to interpret it that way, but it's also one that if you don't want to look at it that way, you don't have to.
So Ophelia gets the golden key, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then that leads her to her next task, which is where we get to the Pale Man scene, which is what Phil wanted to talk about.
Which I do just want to say one thing before you guys go into the Pale Man. Can I just say that the level of gore in this film is not a lot, but my God, it is toe curling.
Oh, well, what's there is
what
nasty.
Little we get is just toe curling is the only word I can use.
Particularly the
where he cuts his face. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was gross.
And what makes it effective is that it's not over the top and not excessive.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Like it's used enough that it's effective and not doesn't bore doesn't not have the word bore you but desensitize you.
Right.
So when those scenes occur, they're that much more palpable.
Yep. It's just enough to make it a good children's film.
Yes. Amen.
And the scene with the Pale Man, I drew a lot of callbacks to World War II of this actually.
Mm-hmm.
What?
The Pale Man and his form is almost like a Holocaust death camp survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And if you notice, in its layer is a pile of shoes.
Yeah.
Very Holocaust.
Yeah.
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 Good one, Abe.
And not to mention, I believe the Pale Man also represents Videl as well. Because there's a scene earlier where he's sitting at a table in the same position as the Pale Man.
Yes.
Oh.
Wait, who does he represent?
There's a parallel.
The captain.
Okay,
yeah,
I thought...
a parallel.
Okay.
There's actually... Go ahead, Abe. Go.
Oh, no. I was curious what you had to say before I go off on a tangent.
Well, no, because I think you and I are on the same page. The Pale Man is a parallel to the captain, because the captain is sitting at his table of food, and it kind of goes back into King Midas, where King Midas had all these riches, but he was a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what, when you look at the Pale Man, that's what you're supposed to see. Because here's the Pale Man with this great banquet of food before him, but he can't eat any of it because all he really wants is children. Which again goes back to the gluttony thing of the toad. So it's all connected. So go ahead, Abe, say what you were going to say.
There's also in the DVD, they had little bonus comics describing the stories behind the creatures. And the Pale Man was actually banished because of his excessiveness. And, you know, his greed. He was expansive with greed and gluttony and stuff like that, actually. And, as you said, you know, with Minos, it was actually a perfect representation of that character as well. Del Toro even mentions something about the key, the knife, the object she needs to retrieve was actually because the comic describes it as the Pale Man thought that the knife was to destroy him. He thought it was a weapon that could harm him, when in fact the knife's presence was the only thing keeping him from disappearing.
Oh, elaborate on that, because I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, apparently that the knife that he got hides in the little safe was okay. Was apparently the only thing that kept him from not collapsing on himself, from vanishing. Because he was not eating anything. He was pretty much only sustained by the power from that weapon, that item. But once Ophelia stole it, he vanished. He disappeared. He had nothing left. So I'm curious if perhaps the knife itself, considering its importance to the Pale Man, has something to do with it, what's going on in the real world as well.
Well, because
there is the knife that Mercedes has later too.
Right, which she hides away.
And then you could go into the razor where, is always shaving his face, but that could also be related to the theme of beauty versus ugliness. Because he was always looking in the mirror, and then he had his mouth and his cheek cut open.
Right.
Which was just about the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. That was brilliant.
It was awesomely disgusting.
Oh, my God. It was so disgusting. It was, such a subtle way.
Before we get to that, just an interesting little trivia here off IMDb, which is that Stephen King attended a screening of the film and sat next to Guillermo del Toro. According to del Toro, King squirmed when the Pale Man chased Ophelia. Del Toro compared the experience of seeing King's reaction to winning an Oscar.
Awesome. Well, good.
Christy, you know how it is with authors and a lot of times – I'll have someone read a story and I'll go, oh yeah, that's awesome. But, in my mind, I don't really like it and whatnot. Do you think this is just King and Del Toro, promoting each other?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because, there is sadly enough, there is something goes on in that secret world. That's between artists or that's between writers, that's between filmmakers. And, we all help each other out. And there is, which is why I kind of am not public about a lot of my opinions about things, because I don't want to go to that place. But that's just me. But yes, I have to say yes. There's definitely some kind of secret club going on there. I don't think he made Stephen King actually squirm, and here's why. Stephen King is actually a little bit... he's more graphic than Del Toro is in his writing because Del Toro is so subtle. What Stephen King's works telegraph to me is that Stephen King needs blood and spatter and gore and disgusting in order to actually make him squirm. He's actually a little bit down a step from Guillermo Del Toro. And yes, I will say that publicly, because Del Toro likes subtlety.
Okay.
Like when they're going to go and cut the leg off the dude, right?
Yeah.
And oh my God, who of us was not here squirming going, oh my God, are you really going to make us see that leg?
Right.
And he cut it right at the right moment. He showed the first cut.
Right.
Which was enough to make me almost want to throw up, and then we didn't see it.
Right.
But in a lot of Stephen King shit, you get people bleeding and blood and gore. It's like the same problem I have with, I love The Walking Dead, but I close my eyes often because it's too much. I'm like, really, you guys are just being silly now. You're throwing brains on the wall. Like, really? This is not making me crawl. This is making me laugh at you because this is not intelligent. You're just throwing.
But that's for gorehounds. I don't know that you can blame this. You can attribute what we see in the Stephen King movies necessarily to the same thing with Stephen King.
Okay. I didn't mean to derail the podcast with this comment. I just thought
it was... Okay, that's okay. Cool. I'm sorry.
I'll say this. I say they both have their merits. It depends on the...
preference.
The preference. Exactly, preference. It's like, Mike, we were discussing in the movie Spring, and... Or Unfriended, for that matter, which is both of them are subgenres of horror that aren't necessary for everybody. And you could, if we want to just go by gore or subtlety or whatever. So, Christy, you have an absolutely great point. I guess it d- depends on who their audiences are, I guess, right?
I mean, it depends on what you like, too. You know, it depends on what you gravitate toward, what you think of. And, like, I remember in Spring, that moment where she showed the bodies and she said, "This is my family." I was so disappointed I couldn't be on the podcast that night because I actually figured out what they were actually looking at. That was a real family. Those were not, that was really there. And right. I was so excited to talk about that and where it was in terms of the Pompeii grid. But it was disturbing. And yet, but you didn't get the graphic, like, let's reenact all this, because you didn't need it. It was more effective when she just said, "This is my family. Here's who they died." That was horrifying.
Before we move on past the Parliament scene, I want to give a little behind the scenes on that. The first was the when she grabs the fairies. Mm-hmm. Doug Jones was actually biting into corn syrup filled condoms for that.
Yep.
Oh, that's weird. How do you, no kidding. So that's how they got the effect.
Yeah, he's pulling off the head. But what they did was, beforehand, they CGI'd the fairy over this moment before Doug Jones, the guy who plays both the Fawn and the Pale Man, seizes it. But at that moment, as he's biting down, they change it off to the condom.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, Doug Jones is very flexible and very interesting. He played both characters in the film. He played Pan and the Pale Man,
Yep.
And if any listeners don't know who he is, he's been in Hellboy. He played Abe Sapien. He played the Silver Surfer in the Fantastic Four. He was in the famous Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode, Hush.
Oh, was he one of the guys?
Yes.
Yeah, he was one of the gentlemen.
Guy. Yeah.
Gentlemen, exactly. That's what they're called. Right, right.
The gentleman. He worked as a contortionist. So he acts with his body, and this is what has garnered him so many roles. But Nathan had him on the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show, March 10th, I think it was March 10th, 2013. I'm sorry, I'm distracted right now because my neighbor has, and Phil, you can cut this out of the episode. My neighbor has peacocks. Like, right next to my driveway, and there's a fox right there out now, and he's eating a peacock, and I can hear the noise, and it's horrifying. So I'm sorry, I'm distracted. Yeah, it's like, I don't even know what to do. I think Nathan's going to go out there now, because I just heard the front door go out, so I think...
I can hear it, actually.
I can hear it, too.
Can you hear it? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's fucking hunting them.
That has got to be one of the most surreal lines I think I've ever had spoken into my ear.
I'm sorry.
There's a fox in my neighbor's yard, and he's eating a peacock.
Yeah, yeah. Because my poor neighbor has peacocks, and they're beautiful peacocks. And I go and feed them when he's on vacation. I'm really horrified right now. But I just heard the front door slam, so I think Nathan went out there with the gun, hopefully.
And the fox appreciates that you've been feeding them.
Yeah.
We can't hear through your microphone, so tell us, what does the fox say?
Oh!
What does a fox say? I don't know right now. Late, it just sounds like
okay.
Yeah.
Too funny.
Can you hear it? It's like screaming.
I know. We can hear it. That's creepy as hell, actually.
Oh, it stopped. Oh, that's... Well, no.
Dead bird.
All right, let's move on.
Okay.
All right.
I might have to close the window. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. I was so distracted because all I can hear is... I'm a little scared. But yeah, we live in the middle of nowhere. So nowhere. We have like 5 acres around us and foxes and birds and peacocks and...
Oh my.
Yeah, deer and... Yeah, so...
All right, so let's see. What further items, what other scenes did we want to discuss? Anybody?
Well, we've got to talk about the mouth.
Well, I also want to say before you go, the thing that is a foreshadowing of bad things happening is the Pale Man tearing through the fairies.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Yep.
That was because the fairies is cute little, you know, like it's, and they're color coded, right? It's sort of like Sleeping Beauty, where you had the three, the red, the green, and the blue fairy.
Mm-hmm.
right? And you get the same sort of thing here. And the pale men, they're like in the teeth, and it's not like a nice little, I just swallow, hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Not like this nice little, sorry, cat sat on the keyboard. Not like a nice little, I swallowed them whole sort of thing, and, you know, you just don't see them again.
I ripped their heads off, and they spurted blood all over the place. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it was just like, and also the sign that you probably shouldn't trust the fawn, because, you know.
That wasn't the fawn. That's not on the fawn. That's on that stupid little girl for eating something while she was in there.
No. That's not what I mean.
Yeah, but no. It's the fact
that he says, yeah, the fact that he says, well, you have to do this, and if you don't do this, you can't be the princess. And then he comes like, oh, fuck, my plans are screwed. All right, here. All right, I wasn't entirely honest about that. We could still keep going, even though it's like, okay, so something clearly he wasn't being straight with her because his plans are more flexible than he let it out to appear, mm-hmm. right?
I have to agree with Mike because I never trusted the fawn. Well, in the first scene, well, in the first scene, when he comes to her and he's older, because we also have the idea of course, reverse aging going on, and that he gets younger throughout the film, which is kind of weird. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also an idea that the further she goes into the fantasy, the worse things get on the outside, the more she kind of goes toward a more perfect fantasy. But he does get younger. But the first time, we as an audience sort of trust him. And then as the film progresses, I have to agree with Mike, I started to not trust him. And then by the time we got to, here I have the knife with the baby, I was like, dude, yeah, I knew this the whole time.
and what were you rooting for there? That she would get the baby for her or not?
No, I don't even know what I felt. Because at that point, I was still not sure whether I should trust the fawn or trust her.
Oh, it was very ambiguous.
Part of the brilliance. I didn't know which way to go.
I kind of bought it when the fawn delivered the line, oh, it'll just be a few drops.
I did too. I was like, oh yeah, dude.
I was like, oh God, I don't know.
And that's a parallel too, because one of Del Toro's prominent themes in all of his films is choice.
Right.
The idea of choice. Even in Mama, which he only produced, which was... I like that film. It had its problems. But Jessica Chastain, the main character, makes a choice to take the girls in. Choice runs through all his films. He is all about choice. Even in that terrible remake he did of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, which I don't even want to discuss because I love the original. But he focused on choice.
I liked it too. So,
yeah, but I love the original. So it was a little rough. In his film, the little girl had a choice. The father had a choice. He's very big. Choice is one of the things in his film. He's like, hey, it's almost like kind of biblical in a sense, where God says you have free will and you can choose, which I find kind of interesting because Del Toro takes that and plays with it in such a non-religious context, if that makes any sense. He plays with it in a mystical context. And that just fascinates me. It's like it's all about choice. Do I make a left out of my driveway or a right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing religious about that. But anyway.
Well,
and you get something like eating the candy off the table, or not the candy, the fruits off the table. That's
the grapes. Yep.
Right. Was that Oedipus? Who was it that went in the underworld and wasn't allowed to look back at? Well, yeah, Persephone actually from who was the daughter of Hestia, I think.
Oh,
but she or Demeter, and but she was kidnapped down to the underworld by Hades, and he was supposed to give her back, and he didn't to make her give her back because her mother was causing wouldn't allow spring to come, and so the world was freezing over. There was no food, and said, okay, she can go as long as she hasn't had anything to eat. But she'd eaten like 6 pomegranate seeds, and so she had to stay back in the underworld for 6 months a year, which is why you had the seasons. But there's also with the whether it was Oedipus or whomever it was that went down to the underworld to rescue his love, but he wasn't allowed to, in order to bring her back, he was never allowed to look at her. And right before they get to the threshold, he turns around and looks and loses her. So you have the same thing that the little girl is in the underworld and she's got it you know, home free, but she's weak and she caves in and she has a couple of grapes or whatever it was she was eating and screws the pooch and everybody dies.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because so, kids have no willpower.
Exactly. Kids suck. but I really want to talk about the scene with Mercedes and the knife. Because there's a scene in this movie where the captain discovers that Mercedes has been part of the resistance. And he takes her out to the torture barn or whatever the hell you want to call that place.
Yeah.
And he has her tied up. And she has this knife that she's been keeping in her apron the whole time. And she gets it out and uses it to cut her ropes and get herself free. And she stabs the captain in the back and then gets him turned around. And she sticks the knife right into his mouth.
Oh, God.
I forget what line she delivers just then, but she delivers some potent line.
She
says something like, "I've gutted pigs worse than you, and I'll do it again," or something like that.
And then she
does anybody remember? Like, it was something like that. It was very shocking.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember either because it was so horrifying. Don't remember the words. I was like, "Oh my god!"
I remember what happens next more. Which is that she just yanks the knife to the right as hard as she can and slices right through his cheek and gives him a smile that extends halfway across his face.
And all I could think of was the Joker in Batman.
Right,
serious. So, just put a smile on that face.
And then if that wasn't bad enough, we get the scene later where he stitches it up. Oh, my God. I don't think I've squirmed that much.
Squirmed. But then he drinks the alcohol and his mouth and the band-aids. I was like, oh my god, stop. You're
kidding. I know. It was awful. Cringe inducing and awesome.
Oh my god. Yeah, that was bad. Even the memory of it is bad right now. I'm like, oh my god, that was horrifying. Cause all the booze leaks out the side of his mouth. And it soaks all the bandages. And that was just...
No,
and to that was a metaphor, like, no matter how much you drink, you cannot kill your pain.
Well, but you notice what he does is that he cringes, and then he takes another drink.
Yeah!
So I'm going to get drunk, even if it kills me.
Because, man, that scene where he stitches himself up and then takes a drink, oh, my God.
But see, here's what's interesting about that. The whole film, he's got this pride looking at himself in the mirror, and he's shaving.
Uh-huh.
And then he sits there and stitches up his face.
Right.
And he takes the same razor that made him look beautiful,
uh-huh.
and he cuts the string on the stitches.
Uh-huh.
So now that has become a tool of his ugliness,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of freaky. Because he even says earlier, you knew where to hit me. You got me where because of my pride.
Yep.
Really well done.
No,
a lot of levels there.
Yep. Yeah. Bill, you've been awfully quiet over there.
Well, oddly, I had to actually leave the podcast temporarily to go and feed my child. And,
damn it, Phil.
So I had to let you folks continue on without me, and as a result, I'm out of the loop a little bit.
Okay, so now it's his turn to talk.
Part three of the podcast. I see how it is.
Is that why you didn't say anything about the whole segue we did about Tom Brady?
Oh, goodness. Let's not even talk to that. Either way, since I don't know exactly what you folks have been talking about recently, what other items have we missed? Have we talked about the frog, for example? Have we talked about...
We talked about the pale man, we talked about the knife.
About the pale man that you wanted to say, Phil, because you wanted to talk about it and then got summoned away?
I just wanted to bring that up as a topic, just for the fact that it's probably become not only an iconic image specifically for this film, but an iconic image for genre film in general in the past 9 years or so. So I was just thought that would have been something of interest to discuss. But it appears you guys already did, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
Well, so, not every creature gets a spotlight in a Simpsons opening credit sequence.
That's true.
And any further things that we wanted to bring up? I don't know where you guys left off, what you guys discussed. So anybody else bring it up?
I kind of made a reference to it earlier, but I just wanted to put out there just what an incredible emotional impact the ending of this movie has. Because you've been following this girl the whole time, and then the very last scene in the movie where she's dying, she's either having her soul transferred to this fantasy world that she's been visiting throughout the whole movie and going to live eternally as a princess, or her life was so goddamn horrible that she escaped to this fantasy land, and this is the very last fantasy that she's having before she dies.
Yeah. It's fucking brutal. It is absolutely brutal.
It's brutal. And I think it's gutting.
The first time I saw this movie, I interpreted the way that she just made the whole thing up in her head to escape this shitty fucking life that she's been living. And I started crying, I'll admit it.
Yeah, at least Jennifer Connelly imagined David Bowie with a massive codpiece.
Right?
What's that? What movie is that from, Mike?
That's from Labyrinth?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Actually, let me ask you this, since you brought up Labyrinth, Mike. Does anybody know, did that film, that Labyrinth, have dead ends or not? Or was it correctly labeled a Labyrinth?
No idea.
Ooh. I don't know. I was wondering that earlier. I would have to go back and rewatch it because I haven't seen it in a while.
I'd have to rewatch it too, but I own it and I'm going to rewatch it because now you got me thinking. I need to see it again because I saw that in the theater when it came out. And then I bought the DVD or the Blu-ray or something, and I bought the video even, and the video is even unopened in my basement. I still have it. I never opened it. So
collector's item.
Maybe. Yeah, totally serious.
eBay.
I'll keep it forever. Yeah. Oh, no. I'll keep it forever. Unless somebody says to me, oh, I really need this film on VHS, then I'll just give it away. But, yeah. But that was back when movies were $100 a pop, so.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I remember
Thank
that.
God we've progressed as a society.
Oh, holy shit. I mean, I have VHSs down there that I will not give away because I literally was like, when do I get peed or like I saved for 5 months to buy a videotape? I mean, it was, you know, you guys know back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yep.
It's a lot of money.
All new movies, or not all, but a good portion of new movies that came out were purposely $80 or $90 a piece because they were trying to, the production companies were trying to rape the rental stores. So they could buy them for that price because they knew the rental stores would buy them. And
right, because the rental stores would rent it to you for $4 and they would do it 100 times. They'd make their money back. They didn't want you going in the end run around the rental stores. And one of the first movies to sort of cut that out, cut through that loophole, was Batman, which came out like 6 months after the movie did.
Yep.
Came out for $19.99 at Christmas time.
Yep.
And so it just bypassed the rental store. And that really set in a completely unrelated way to Pan's Labyrinth, sort of set the precedent for where the market has come to now, which is, you know, going straight to the consumer 6 months or now even less after being released in the theater and hype the shit out of the film up front and get the people the video in their hands before the hype is completely settled down.
Yeah. I paid $95 for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Sucker!
On VHS when it was first released. But my dad helped me out. Because I called him up and said, Daddy, I love this movie. I know, but my dad had also bought us Raiders of the Lost Ark and Empire Strikes Back at $120.
Oh, you had a good dad.
I did have a good dad. He was an awesome dad. he really was. He was like, we have to own Raiders. I'm going to get it for all four of you kids for Christmas.
Awesome.
I'm like, okay. But he also spent a lot of other money on us. But I was like, Dad, that's $120. He goes, it doesn't matter. You kids are going to watch this over and over and over. And we did. God bless us. I know every line of that film. But it was amazing. You know, he also bought us Raise the Titanic when it came out. Who remembers that film?
I'm raising my hand in case you can't see
I'm
me.
Here. I'm, okay, thank you, Mike. I love
I that never
film.
Saw it, but I remember it.
Oh, my God.
Actually, I don't... Wait a minute. I don't know if I saw it, because there might be other things. But I do remember it coming out.
I am sitting right now in my office looking at the original movie poster from the 70s. Oh, that's cool. I'll put it on your Facebook page, Mike, just for fun.
Cool.
But yeah, but my father, when that movie was released on video cassette, it was $125. And he decided he loved this movie so much, he had to have it. So when the VHS craze hit, these were the four movies I watched. Empire Strikes Back over and over and over, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Raiders of the Titanic, and Telefon over and over and over, because that was the only four movies we watched. But what's scary is that was a $500 movie collection.
Yeah,
stop and think about that now. A $500 collection now is like, you know, you could have hundreds of movies for that.
Yeah, on a flash drive.
Then you own six.
Yeah,
on a flash drive, exactly. Back then you owned six.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, so unless anybody wanted to bring another thing up, I guess we could probably wrap up the episode. Who wants to give their final thoughts? Well, Abe, since you chose this film as your film for the contest, or I should say the poll, why don't you give your final thoughts?
It's a great film. It's visually stunning, very subtle in its themes, but very rich in them as well. I mean, there's a lot you can interpret from it. A lot of mythology in it. The performances of all the actors and actresses are solid. It's certainly one of Del Toro's bleakest and darkest films. He has moments of leniency and lightness in other films, but this one was, considering the setting in general, Paleman aside and Vidal is put on the other side, you know, just the setting itself is just dark, still in a war-torn nation. And I was absolutely blown away when I saw this film, and I can't recommend it enough to folks. It's a great film. I mean, not everyone's going to like it, but it's definitely a recommendation for me.
Very good. All right, I'll go next. It's an incredibly well done film. It most certainly deserved its Academy Awards for the effects and things of that nature. The screenplay actually is an amazing screenplay and shows that Del Toro is most certainly a talent, not just as a director, but also as a writer, though he's probably his best aspect of his career or him himself is his ability to show I guess special effects to the things that he imagines and puts upon the screen for all of us to see, whether it's this film or Hellboy 2 for that matter and other films. For me, the film isn't one of my favorite films. It's a good film. It's definitely not a film that I wanted to revisit when it won the poll. But I am glad I have seen it because I do like it more now than I did the first time I watched it. Again, my perspective was specifically related to the fact that I was going in expecting this dark horror film when it was definitely a dark film, but it wasn't the type of horror film I was expecting. It was as we discussed, it's more of a fantastical film about a young girl who happens to be in a situation, a dire situation, that makes her life so miserable that she has to go into this fantasy world that it itself has some scary and heartbreaking moments. And yet that's what I was not expecting since I went into the film blind when I first saw the film and did not expect that type of a film. But that stated, it is a good film, and folks should certainly check it out and make their own decision. I'm gathering that most folks will actually probably like the film, unless you're simply not into fantasy or science fiction or genre film in general, such as, say, my wife, who isn't a fan of those type of films. She probably would not like it. But anybody that listens to this podcast would probably like it. So I will give it a thumbs up, even if it's not one of my favorite films. Eric?
I don't know what to say with it. It's been said already.
I really love this film. Owned it on Blu-ray. Catch a little something else every time I watch it. And like Phil was saying, it won't be for everybody, but even people who aren't necessarily into the subject material will still not be able to deny the craft with which the movie was made. It did win several Oscars, and it won for a reason, because it was really just a phenomenal piece of filmmaking. So if you haven't gotten this under your belt yet, I highly recommend checking it out.
Very good. And Mike?
Like I said, I'm a Del Toro fan. I think he's one of those directors that, if as a fantasy director or a horror director or whatever genre he's in, it sort of like reminds me a bit of Tim Burton, that he has a distinct visual style that if you know it, you recognize it immediately in terms of his designs and his creatures, because there's nothing else quite like them. And, you know, you can compare like the Pale Man and the Fawn, say, to the Angel of Death in Hellboy 2, and you can see a lot of connections there, or the Tooth Fairies, right, from that film. I don't know that this is my favorite of his films. It is a very strong film. I might need to watch it a couple more times for everything to sort of sink in. But my recommendation is, if you have a daughter or any nieces who want to become a princess, is sit them down and watch this with them, especially if they're at a very young age. And hopefully this will cure them of that ill.
All right, and Christy.
High recommend. Very high recommend, especially if you like films that will make you think over and over. Like Eric said, every time you watch this film, you're going to see something different. This was my first occasion to watch this. I plan to watch it many more times. But I think, I don't know that fans of like splatterpunk or gore horror will like it. But if you like psychological stuff, if you like Poe, if you like Shirley Jackson, if you like Gabriel Garcia Marquez outside of the horror realm, if you like magical realism, you will love this film. It's very disturbing. It's very dark. And definitely everybody needs to see this. I would agree with it. Even if you watch it for 5 minutes and say, this isn't for me, you just got to try it.
Yep, very good. All right, so that's Pan's Labyrinth, which 2006, again, gained numerous accolades throughout the 9 years that it's since it's been out. And as we discovered, two people, Mike and Christy, have finally discovered this film just this month, or at least in the past 30 days. So it shows you something that it probably will be remembered many years from now, no matter where Del Toro's career goes, and no matter that I'm not necessarily a big fan. All right, so I guess we can wrap it up. So, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thank you, Christy, for joining us tonight. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to listen to us talk about Pan's Labyrinth. Come back next week. We'll have a different topic.